The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In-your-face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello and welcome again to the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today we'll be joined by my pal, MSNBC host Stephanie Ruhle. But before we get started with Steph, this from Exxon and Mobil Synergy Gasoline. Engineered to provide better gas mileage, lower emissions, and improve engine responsiveness with seven key ingredients. Stop by your nearest Exxon or Mobil station today to experience Synergy Gasoline. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. I have done a lot of different things on television, but I have never had more fun than I'm having right now, going on once a week and sometimes more than that with Stephanie Ruhle, the hardest working woman in show business. You see her on MSNBC at 9, then you see her with Ali Velshi again at 11 o'clock most mornings. She came out of, she came out of the banking industry where she was trying desperately to be a one percenter and then ended up at Bloomberg Television and is an ascendant star at MSNBC and one of my favorite people on the planet. And Stephanie, you know, you were reminding me the other day that the first time we worked together on television, it was because of everybody's All-American, Ryan Lochte.
Do you mean when you tried to tell me that Ryan Lochte, what is he, age 32, 33, is just a kid? Is that what you meant to tell me? You know, when I was 32, 33, much like you, probably had one or two kids, a career. So a man who is a gold medalist, a silver medalist, and not one, but I believe two Olympics. Well, gosh darn it, was just a kid. That's when I gave you the gong and the showtime of the Apollo hook and dragged you off television. Well, here we are 10 months later back together.
All right. To set the scene, Stephanie this morning is in Washington. We are taping this podcast with Representative Steve Scalise, still in critical condition after the injuries he suffered on a ball field in Alexandria, Virginia, in a crazy moment in America. On any other day, four dead, including the shooter at a UPS facility in San Francisco, would have been the story, but not yesterday because of what happened in Congress. And Stephanie, this is a long way of asking you this. There was a moment of grace, an uncommon moment of grace that lasted throughout the day on Wednesday in Washington, and one that lasted basically until the president of the United States woke up this morning and picked up his phone and started tweeting.
You're right, but I'm going to tell you I'm more optimistic than you. Yes, yesterday the president gave very presidential remarks, and, you know, as expected, he woke up today without having a script or a teleprompter or his staff, and he took to Twitter and almost immediately dug into Robert Mueller and saying people involved in the investigation are bad. And he referred to the Russia investigation that there's show me proof of collusion. This is the greatest witch hunt in American history. Well, first we can dissect that because the president is in risky waters if he's demanding proof. Because at the same time, if he's looking for proof, so we're also looking for proof that there are tapes of James Comey. We're looking for the president's proof that there was criminal wiretapping on the part of President Obama or the Obama administration. But in terms of this moment of unity and optimism yesterday from the president, we did have the moment yesterday. We don't have the moment today. But I sat down earlier with a Republican congressman from North Carolina who happens to be the starting pitcher for the team tonight. And he said he wants to keep that unity. I also spoke to Adam Kinzinger from Illinois who said he really wants this to be a moment, a time to turn the page in terms of bipartisanship. And maybe this is a pipe dream on my part, Michael. But maybe put the president aside. Maybe these lawmakers can actually do it. They met the president a year ago, many of them. The president has given a harder time to almost all of them on both sides of the aisle than they have one another. Maybe this is a time where they say, we don't care about these distractions. We don't want to talk about all the nonsense the president does. We certainly don't want him tweeting. What if we as lawmakers figure out a way to work together and they work around the president. Maybe I'm delusional, but I think we have a higher probability of that happening today as some sort of silver lining from the horrible attack that took place yesterday, even if the president is back to his old tricks.
I'm talking to my pal, Stephanie Ruhle, on the Mike Lupica podcast. And Steph, here's the amazing thing. The president's tweets this morning weren't nearly the most shameful that I've read lately, because the most shameful came from a former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, who is suggesting that Robert Mueller is part of some dark net conspiracy to take down the president of the United States.
Mike Lupica, I would like Newt Gingrich to just back it up for a moment. Kellyanne Conway earlier this week making the argument several people to Robert Mueller who've hired have given money to Democrats. Well, you know who else has given money to Democrats? President Donald J. Trump, his daughter Ivanka, Jared, and his economic advisor, Gary Cohn, is a Democrat. So I completely understand and appreciate the anxiety and the nervousness and probably the outrage and upset in the White House around Robert Mueller being there. But he's doing his job. He has not even been in the job for 4 weeks. So to say, when are you going to get this thing over and done with? I take you back to Whitewater. Took years, years.
I heard you talking about that today. Like, when are we going to wrap this up? He's only been, you pointed out today, he's only been on the job a month.
I mean, and this puts Republicans in a really hard position. And you wonder, maybe the president has nothing to lose in terms of his approval rating, is whether it's in the low 40s or 30s. If he were to fire Robert Mueller, would that push his approval rating down? Certainly. But what would be worse, if you left Robert Mueller in that position and he could find something else? Unclear. But if you're a Republican, if you're a sitting Republican right now, you're just wishing that the president would stop talking.
Yeah, not only just stop talking, but to stop taking the level of discourse to the same course level that helped get him elected. And I understand that in moments like yesterday, and we all began to process it as early as 7:30 yesterday morning, there will be a rush, as President Obama said when he gave that wonderful eulogy in Dallas after the shooting of the policeman out there. Everybody rushes to their respective corners. Okay, so you knew that was going to happen. You knew that that is an inevitable part of this. But for people on the right to talk about how somehow the Democrats did this and completely ignore the rhetoric of the campaign is pretty rich to me.
Michael, there has been extraordinarily aggressive rhetoric on both sides, without a doubt. But you can't, there's no way the far right can directly point and say this was an act of liberal terrorism. This was a lone wolf. This was a horrible situation. And we don't know enough about this man yet. But we need the leaders of our country to raise the bar and say we've got to pull things to a higher level. The country desperately needs it. I mean, on Monday, Michael, when Ivanka Trump came on television, and I do believe she was speaking from her heart, and said, "It was a surprise to me when I came to Washington how vicious things are."
Oh, I know.
The problem
know.
Is, Michael, it's very difficult to listen to Ivanka Trump say that, who was on the campaign trail while her father said, "Lying Ted, little Marco, lock her up." I mean, we're talking about the bully in chief. And so to say the viciousness is merely coming at the Trumps, it is also deeply rooted in what they are putting out. I point you to Don Jr. and Eric. Remember how upset, how angry everyone was when Hillary Clinton used the word deplorables? Well, last week on Fox News, Eric Trump said that there are people far on the left he doesn't even consider humans.
And he's worried about rhetoric now. And I mean, Bernie Sanders getting dragged into this to me was so incredibly unfair. I said this morning, you know, yeah, blame Bernie, not another guy who shouldn't have had a gun in America. Blame Bernie Sanders for this. After everything we have heard over the last 12 months, we're talking to my friend Stephanie Ruhle. Again, you can watch her at 9 on MSNBC Eastern Time, 11. And then you have another show. Another show
on Saturday
morning with Allie. What
I do on Saturdays, we break down sort of President Trump's policies, specifically around the economy and jobs. You know, it's funny, this being, you know, the White House wanted this to be Workforce Development Week. And I got to tell you, I was actually looking forward to it. In terms of job training and workforce development, it's really important. When you think about the huge faction of America, that forgotten portion of America who has gone through the financial crisis and said, hold on, I didn't get a raise. I live in a factory town. I lost my job. It's now been replaced by an automated task. What am I going to do? So workforce development is important, and the White House can do a lot. I mean, Michael, there's a great argument to be made. We have 47 different workforce development programs in this country across 13 different government agencies with a budget of $16.7 billion. Those three facts, put that against all of these people in this country who are not getting raises, who are not in fulfilling jobs, and who do not have the skills for tomorrow's jobs. And there is a lot of streamlining and smart business to be done, yet we're not getting to talk about this, not because the liberal media is avoiding it, because the president isn't putting it front and center.
Stephanie, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question as a
That's
parent.
That's a good idea.
Parent to parent, okay? I have four children. You have three. I mean, obviously, four is extreme parenting. Three is a very noble enterprise, but, you know, four kicks it up to another level. My sons are in their 20s. My daughter just graduated from high school. Your children, obviously, are much younger. In your adult life, have you ever been more concerned about not just the future of our country, but the future of the world than you are at this particular moment in our history?
Am I scared? I'm sad, Michael. In terms of equality, sure, I felt like we were moving way too slow. I'm tired that the gender pay gap is what it is. I'm tired we don't have more women running Fortune 500 companies. But I never, ever thought we would be moving backwards. And that's where we are right now. You know, my children, they didn't know the word racism. Not until, you know, 6-10 months ago. I am scared at the level of hate in the country right now, the way that we're treating one another, and I am begging the leaders of our country to raise the bar. The one piece of silver lining here is maybe this will truly invigorate and engage people. And I don't just mean people all the way on the left or all the way in the right, but people in the middle who tend to get complacent, people who don't vote in primaries, they don't vote in their local elections, they don't want to get involved in politics. Maybe this will get people to reclaim their power and say, my God, the president said on Inauguration Day, it is time to give power back to the people. Well, then if people want it, this is their time to take it. We all get a vote.
I want to go back to something I talked about a minute ago. Isn't it amazing how numb we have gotten to gun violence in this country in this sense, just in this sense? And on any other day, what happened in San Francisco would likely have led the network news and been a huge story all day long. But because the shooter was shooting at Republican congressmen on a ball field in Alexandria, Virginia, and ended up dead the way the shooter did in San Francisco, that trumped everything. But basically, and again, we're having this conversation with Representative Scalise still in critical condition. But let's say this plays out with only the shooter having died. We had two mass shootings in America on the same day on different
it's
sides of the country.
But Michael, I don't think we're numb to it. I think on some level we're in despair. I mean, yesterday, just 2 hours after the shooting, Rand Paul, who was obviously an eyewitness, he was in the batting cage when it happened. I remember listening to him recounting the story, and he said, well, when I first heard the gunshots being fired, you know, I wasn't alarmed at first because I'm from the South, so I hear gunshots. And he said, but given the speed in which the bullets were being fired off, it sounded like an AR-15. And I thought to myself, is it not extraordinary that Rand Paul knows what a semi-automatic weapon
yep.
sounds like, an AR-15. And you know, when the London attack happened a couple weeks ago, the men in the van who went into the local pub with knives, President Trump actually put a tweet out that didn't make sense that said, did you notice we're not talking about guns here? Exactly, Mr. President. If there were access in Europe to guns like there is here, it wouldn't be 10, 15, 20 people being attacked. It would be 120. And if you think about yesterday, the shooter, there are lots of people disgruntled in any town, in any family. Things are heated. People feel alone. It's very scary that people are pushed to an edge and they have access to such aggressive weapons. When you've got somebody with a semi-automatic weapon in his hand, even if the police are there, they don't have that kind of weaponry on them.
No, that's what was so extraordinary about this moment in Alexandria, that those two Capitol police officers were able to basically not just shoot back, but take this guy down using handguns. And you know, when we talk about AR-15, and I know the gun companies love to market them as sport rifles. No, no, they're military assault weapons that should never, ever, ever be in the hands of the public.
There is a chance, and we can hope, you know, on the heels of all of this, we know there's always going to be a very clear divide in the gun debate. But to your point, an AR-15 is not a sport rifle. It's an assault rifle. Maybe we will see some sort of more centered uprising trying to decipher what would actually be a hunting rifle, what would be something for protection versus just these weapons meant for mass killing.
And no, I referenced the president's tweet in the column that I wrote in the Daily News this morning about we're not having a gun debate now. Now, thank the Lord we didn't have it. You're exactly right. Thank the Lord we didn't have a gun debate after London, because if they'd had those assault weapons, Steph, you're right. How many people would have died on London Bridge that night?
Michael, two weeks ago in Paris, right outside Notre Dame, the attacker who went after the police officer had a hammer. That's all he had access to, a hammer. Imagine if he had a gun. Hundreds, thousands of people visit that cathedral every day as tourists and to worship. What if he had more than a hammer?
We're talking with Stephanie Ruhle on the Mike Lubega podcast. Much more with Stephanie after this from Helix Mattresses. One size fits all never really fits, right? So then why is your mattress one size fits all? Well, because a truly customized mattress will cost you $5,000 to $10,000 until now. You have to check out Helix.com. Here's what I want you to do. Go to HelixSleep.com, answer a few simple questions, and they'll run a 3D biomechanical model of your body, resulting in an optimized mattress that's completely custom to your needs. It will also be the most comfortable mattress you've ever slept on. They can even customize each side of the mattress for couples. Your mattress arrives at your door in about a week, and shipping is completely free. And here's my favorite part. You have 100 nights to try it out. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up for free and give you a full refund. No questions asked. Go to HelixSleep.com/Mike and get $50 off your order right now. That's HelixSleep.com/Mike for $50 off HelixSleep.com/Mike. Stephanie Ruhle is my guest on the Mike Lupica podcast. And by now she knows that I have the attention span of a hummingbird. So there's something I want to get to before we get back to politics and a career that brought her to this moment where she's become this kind of star on cable television. Explain your devotion to the Golden State Warriors, who won another championship the other night.
I love Steph Curry. Steph Curry is the ultimate athlete. We talked about leadership in this country. We need leaders for our kids to look up to. How about Steph Curry, right? Kid who is the definition of practice makes perfect, okay? He went to Davidson College. Look at what a humble, great family guy. Why do my kids love going to Warriors games? They love going to Warriors games because an hour before the game starts, you get to see the Steph Curry show, how he simply stands there and shoots and shoots and shoots. And if there's anything that we can teach our kids today, it doesn't matter what your natural talent is. It's working hard and being dedicated, and I absolutely love it. You know what else I love about this season? How about Kevin Durant joining the team? And those two figuring out how to swim in the water immediately together. When you get superstars like that joining the same team, it could take a while for their egos to really get on the same team. It seemed overnight. I loved when they won. Kevin Durant immediately goes straight to his mother, talking about growing up in Maryland, what they went through. I just think they're just a great team. It's a great story. I love them. I wish I could say that about the Knicks. Listen, there's nothing better to do in New York City than go to a Knicks game.
Yeah.
But at this point, beyond the Nick City dancers, like, what else I got going for?
What did you? Were there any anxious moments for you in the second half when it looked like LeBron and them might make a run even into the fourth quarter?
I love those anxious moments. I mean, well, that's the thing. Like, you love watching these games. So on one hand, I'm like, I wouldn't mind another game because I love watching them play so much. And listen, I like the Cavaliers. I love Kyrie. I like LeBron. You know, LeBron was so angry, but I like a close game. Unless you're a spoil sport, nobody likes a blowout. If you like sport, you want to see a close game. You want to see them do really well. I mean, I thought it was a great series, and I'm thrilled that the Warriors won.
Have you ever been any more nervous doing anything than you were giving commencement address at your alma mater, Lehigh, a few weeks ago?
You know, I got to tell you, I saw you just before. I was very, very nervous. And the funny thing, I mean, I speak every day, but to go back to Lehigh where I went to school exactly 20 years after I graduated, and I didn't actually like going to school there very much. It was a really, really hard thing to pull off. And I got to tell you, I'm really glad I did it.
You know, after we did the show that day, I watched the entire commencement address on the way home. Here's what impressed me about it. There were obviously there was more than one thing that impressed me about it, because I've only done a high school commencement, but I know how hard it is. You were not afraid to talk about how college was tough for you. Talk a little about that.
You know, I toiled over whether or not I should, because it should be joyous. These kids are graduating college. But I think if somebody asks you to come speak and you want it to count, I think you're supposed to tell the truth. And I think that whether it's college or the day you get engaged or the day you get your first big job, right? There are these moments that are supposed to be like your greatest moments, right? You're supposed to like take a picture of it, tell everyone, this is the greatest moment in my life yearbook. Well, what happens in real time if they're not? And I think that it's okay, and I think it's empowering to tell people that. And I also think that, yes, graduating college is a huge achievement, but we put all this pressure on ourselves and our kids. Like, what's your big idea? Are you going to be the next Mark Zuckerberg? Are you going to be a great entrepreneur? Like, how about instead of, like, being the best and the greatest and the biggest, just try to be good to one another. You know, and I think college especially, you go to college and you're nervous, you don't know where you are, and you're trying so hard to be something you're not. And I think the hardest thing so many of us go through is figuring out who the hell you are and then try to be your best self. That's why, like, for me, I was actually my happiest in my 30s rather than I was my 20s, because you've all these years where you're desperately trying to be someone. You're looking at someone saying, I want to emulate them. I want to be this person. And finally, when, I don't know, you reach about 35 and you look in the mirror and you're like, guess what? I'm not getting any taller. I'm not getting any younger. And I don't really think I'm going to be the next Zuckerberg. Only then can you say, this is who I am and it's pretty damn good. Let me make the most of it. I remember graduating college. I remember feeling not enough. I remember, hey, where are you going to work? Are you moving to New York? Are you working at the best bank? Are you doing this? You know what? Screw that. People don't really care where you're working, who you're dating, what school your kid goes to. Instead, like, try to be a little bit nice to people, and I think you'll go a hell of a lot farther.
We'll have more with Stephanie Ruhle after this from ZipRecruiter. Whether football, basketball, or baseball is your sport of choice, you know that the key to winning is a strong roster. So when you're hiring in business, you need to get the best talent and use ZipRecruiter. At ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your position. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate, listen to this, in just 24 hours. And right now, my listeners can start forming their own winning team on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. Try it for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. talking to my pal Stephanie Ruhle on the Mike Lupica podcast. And by the way, thank you for saying screw you, because, you know, I was going to point out, and not in an encouraging way, that this is a podcast, so you can talk the way, you know, like you normally do to me on the breaks.
I don't ever use profanity, Michael. I don't know what you're implying. The mother of three, there's no profanity being used. I'm sorry. Must be speaking someone else.
To borrow an old line, Stephanie is where sailors go to learn how to swear.
That may be true.
Tell me how you made the move, because we've never talked about this, because everything's happening fast and in real time when we're getting ready to do the show. How did you make the transition from the banking business to going on camera with Bloomberg?
It's a pretty cool story. So I was in investment banking for 14 years. I was at Credit Suisse for 6 years, and Deutsche Bank for 8, and I was in structured credit derivatives. And I really did like banking, but I always was interested in media. But I think people don't pursue their dreams when they have a day job. And banking's a great industry, and it's especially great industry for women who want to have families, because you can, I don't know, for maybe it sounds inappropriate, you can make a lot of money in a short amount of time. And having financial independence enables you to make a lot of decisions somewhat untethered. And when I was in my 30s, I had 2 kids. And after the financial crisis, I thought a lot about jobs versus careers. And when you have 2 little kids at home, it's a hard decision to make to not be with them, especially if you have jobs that require you to travel a lot. And I thought a lot about what I was doing. And after the crisis, we were able to do a lot less, obviously, in the industry, but people, and rightfully so, were mad at banks. Banks got the worst name. They did a terrible job defending themselves. And also at the time, I started to do a lot of public speaking. I talked about the markets, but I spent a lot of time doing public speaking around women and girls, trying to encourage girls to study finance, women to go into business, to stay in business after they have careers, after they have children. And one day I was giving a speech for a nonprofit called the White House Project, which was a nonprofit that was nonpartisan, but it was aimed at getting a woman one day to the White House. And after, the founder had the corporate counsel sitting having lunch, and she said, women and minorities are often lumped together, women and minorities. And she said, if you take the 50 most powerful African-American men in the country, they do a lot to help one another. Look at someone like Jesse Jackson, who, you know, could call Ford Motor Company up on a Tuesday and say, you're going to issue debt, and are you going to give any of your underwriting fees to a minority-owned firm? You should. And oftentimes, there'll be results. And she said, women who are senior across industries don't think that way yet. As soon as one woman gets on a board, they think, okay, I'm safe. And she said, each of you are senior in your industries. You should each think about what you want to do next, and someone else should get you there. And I thought about it, and I came back and I said, you know what? I've always wanted to work in the media. You know, it's financial industry, banking industry fuels the American dream. It's how the country was built. And I think I want to tell some of those stories. And there was another woman in the group who worked directly for Mike Bloomberg. She ran human capital for Bloomberg. And she said, Bloomberg's the place to do it. And soon after, she introduced me to Andy Lack. And Andy Lack said, in the new world of media, there's not going to be any TV presenters reading teleprompters, which is good because I'm terrible at doing that. And he said, in the new world, you have to know content and love content. And again, I'd never worked in TV, and I said, I'm both of those things. And I said, so you can pay me nothing, give me the worst seat in the place, fire me at any time, but I would come here if you gave me a show to anchor and you hired somebody to teach me to be on TV. And Andy said, I'm in if you're in. And that was that. And so that was about 5.5 years ago. And just by dumb luck, within the first couple months I was there, a story that ended up that year sort of being one of the biggest stories in the financial market.
Oh, the London Whale. The London Whale. Yeah.
But the thing is, Michael, I'm one of the reporters who broke the story, but it was dumb luck. The story fell in my lap. And it fell in my lap because it was the exact business that I came from. It was a derivatives trader taking outsized bets in the credit markets. And it was more a story that kind of fell into my lap in a cocktail party context of people who I knew, my former friends and colleagues and coworkers, saying, hey, have you ever heard of this guy? Have you heard of this? Have you heard of this? And the buzz just started getting bigger and bigger. And I walked into Bloomberg and I said, hey, has anybody heard about this story? And I started telling it, and people's jaws dropped. And they said, do you realize what you just found? And from there, sort of how the London Whale at least from the Bloomberg side reporting, it was one of the ways it began. And so it just ended up being an extraordinary run and ride at Bloomberg. And I loved it there. I mean, Bloomberg, Mike Bloomberg is an extraordinary guy. And it's an
I love him.
Company.
I love him. Stephanie, I love him. And I'll tell you, we got off to a rocky start when he was mayor. I thought when I was started writing columns for the front of the paper, I thought the Olympics in New York was a terrible idea. And so we had
Dan Doctoroff must have loved you, Mike.
No, he hates me to this day, and it's okay. It's a long line. But then one day I wrote a column, and I don't even remember what the whole column was about, but it dealt with Mike, and I said the thing he's going to be remembered for is the noble crusade he has led for gun sanity in this country, and it's every time that's all the other things he's done. And about 10 o'clock that morning, I got a call from his assistant. We got on the phone, and I said to him, anytime you want a platform for this particular subject, you've got it. And it became the basis. I'm not calling us friends, but we've had a tremendous relationship ever since. And listen, he could have stayed mayor forever as far as I'm concerned. And I wish it was him. Stephanie, I wish it was him who would become president of the United States.
Michael, I think a lot of people do, but the truth is, if Mike Bloomberg ran, I think it would have increased the chances for President Trump to win. And I think Mike knew that. I think Mike did all, like, we know Mike so well, and it's easy to say, I'd love to see that guy be mayor of New York City forever, but I'm not sure that outside New York, Mike is as well-known a guy. And you forget, Donald Trump was very, very well-known to Americans. Yes, we've known him for 30 years, but The Apprentice was a primetime TV show on network TV. So people are watching The Apprentice at 9 o'clock at night on their couches, in their beds, in their pajamas, in their kitchen. That's an intimate relationship that you build with these TV characters. It's one of the reasons why reality TV became so extraordinarily successful. And you saw Donald Trump, whether it's true or not, build this persona of this straight shooting, tough talking, no BS, New York business titan. And then when it came time to run, because again, look at Donald Trump's base. It's not the people who know him best in the city where he's grown up, built his business, and lived his whole life. It's people in other parts of the country who learned to know him and love him watching The Apprentice. And that's where sort of the rubber is hitting the road here in the disconnect of, I thought you were the straight shooting businessman. I remember Richard Branson said to me during the campaign, and he did not want President Trump to win. He said, I'd love to see a pragmatic businessman be the president of the United States. That's just not what that's not what Donald Trump is. And he was right. And in terms of getting to policy and the agenda, the president's not doing that. And I know firsthand from people I report about inside the White House, you've got people who were not with President Trump on the campaign trail, but they joined saying, I want to work on tax reform. I want to work on deregulation. And there's a massive amount of frustration that they can't get the president to focus on that. And if he decides to go back to his comfort zone and go out on the road and do these rallies like he did, where he's very happy on the campaign trail, it's not just a risk to the White House that he gets distracted. It will make it tougher for his administration to set policy, because you know when he gets on that podium, he makes promises, big time promises, that then he leaves to the guys back in the office to fulfill. One of the reasons it will be so hard to write tax reform, and it has been so hard to write healthcare policy. I mean, what Paul Ryan wants to write is not what President Trump has promised. I mean, when he continues to say, this is going to be the greatest tax reform we've ever seen, the biggest, the best, I take you back to that one page bullet point of what they're going to do. None of it has actually been fleshed out yet. And when we saw tax reform to that grand level that the president is speaking of, it was Ronald Reagan who did it, and it took over a year and a half and a massive amount of bipartisanship. If you ever watch the speech he gave the day they signed that, he must have spent 20 minutes going down the list of all the people to thank. President Trump does not want to get involved in the weeds, and I actually think That's what people thought he could do. Not be a wonky policy guy, but be a true business guy who was not beholden to special interest groups, but could say, let's look at this from a reasonable standpoint and get things done. And that's not what he's done. What he's done is created brilliant, short sound bites that sound great on podiums, at parties. We're going to stop this. We're going to break this. We're going to say no to that. Well, you can repeal, 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 but we need to see what you're going to replace with. And that's the same thing when we look at Mick Mulvaney's budget. Listen, if there's way too many agencies, if you want to clean it up, if you want to prioritize it, fantastic. But if all we're seeing is cut, 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 then you're going to have people lose. We need to see what's the formula for people to win.
We're talking to Stephanie Ruhle, who's it sounds like I'm sucking up, but I'm not. She's one of my favorite people and one of the smartest, most talented people I know. How creepy did you find that cabinet? We haven't talked about this. How creepy did you find that cabinet meeting the other day?
Miguelito, the only way to describe it as a whole other level. And I'm going to tell you what was most shocking to me.
Yeah.
We have been told for months that while Jared and Ivanka do not have the classic qualifications to be senior advisors to the president, what they do have is the ability to have the president's ear. And they would be this moderating force, those who would help the president get centered. We've yet to see that. And in fact, I heard, when did the president have that cabinet meeting? On Tuesday? I heard on Wednesday, Jared was saying to other people in the White House, wasn't that a great meeting? I thought it was great. Great to start the day off that way. And I thought to myself, Jared Kushner thinks that was a good idea. I mean, I've never worked in government. I mean, only until a few months ago did I ever even focus on politics. But I spent a long time working in corporate America. There is no corporation, public or private, on planet Earth where a CEO would sit down with his senior advisors around him. And basically, remember, it was taped, so you would view that as like a company town hall with the entire company watching as one by one each division head would go around and say, I mean, let's pretend it's Disney. Can you imagine around the horn, Bob Iger, I want to tell you, you are the smartest, most wonderful. It is the greatest honor of my life here on planet Earth to work for someone as super spectacular, intergalactic as you. And it's this strange moment of, are we not so, is this not a democracy? There's no, you know, worshiping false idols here. And it takes me back to when you see the president in these moments during the administration when he's most frustrated. I think there are these moments when he forgets that there are three separate and equal branches of government. When he gets mad, you know, Congress doesn't work for me or the judges don't work for me. And so he loves to see those people he's appointed into those positions shower him with love. I take you to his foreign trip. He was so happy in Saudi Arabia, a country that, by the way, for years he railed against. He loved doing the sword dance, touching that magic globe, being treated like royalty. He likes speaking to autocrats like Erdogan, like a leader of the Philippines. Yet when he's meeting with NATO leaders or the G7, where they all sort of walk hand in hand, walk down the street together, shake hands, he doesn't like that so much. You remember what was it, the leader of Latvia? I can't remember what country that he sort of shoved so he could stand.
Oh, the new prime minister of Montenegro.
Yes, Montenegro, excuse me. Or when they were in Sicily and they're all supposed to walk through the town together, but the president opted to take a golf cart. He's not into sort of the community, let's all be together. He likes the royal treatment. So when you watch that cabinet meeting on Tuesday, you watch the president getting the royal treatment. Now, I'm sure, and George Bush said it himself just maybe a month or two ago when he was on the Today Show, and he said, listen, it's very easy when you're the president for things to get to your head, but if you're the president with so much on your plate, I do not envy President Trump. What he has on his plate is massive, but you have to have people around you that are going to tell you the truth and push against you. And when we continue to blame Steve Bannon or Stephen Miller, we go, oh no, Stephen Bannon's in charge again. Stephen Bannon's not in charge. Reince Priebus isn't in charge. Stephen Miller isn't. President Trump is in charge. He's the only person who was elected. So you can't blame anyone but him for his actions.
Oh, Stephanie, there's a great title of an old Jim Boughton book called I Manage Good, But Boy Did They Play Bad, that speaks to what we see. And there's a broader question with Trump. And you're absolutely right. His whole attitude is, why won't they do what I want them to do when I want them to do it? And it's the presidency of enough about me. What do you think about me? But do you think he can
be really know what he wants them to do? He hasn't articulated, you know, he told John Dickerson from CBS when John had been pressing him, I believe it was about wiretapping, I don't remember, but he said, I don't stand for anything. I don't stand for anything. Your word is your bond. You know, we're talking about, well, was James Comey setting a bear trap for President Trump in his testimony? Because if Trump has to go under oath, he can't lie. You're darn right he can lie. The last time he was under oath, when he was in that lawsuit that Tim O'Brien, who wrote the book about President Trump, was involved with, I'm going to get the number wrong, but I want to say President Trump, while under oath, it was realized he must have lied 2 dozen times.
I think it's 30. I actually think it's, yeah. And, you know, Steve Schmidt said something to us the other day, and I was telling my wife about it later, that he said, you could sit around with Trump and you could be in the inner circle, but you have to have told him one thing. You could send out tweets, you could do this, you could do that, but don't do anything that ever gets a special counsel hired. And that's the fix he's in now. That's the fix he's in.
You know what's funny about the special counsel? If you look at what's happening with Uber, Uber could end up being a cautionary tale for the president. Uber thought it was, listen, Uber had lots of sexual harassment issues kind of swirling around the company. They had lots of little stories for years about bad culture, you know. It's a company started by a young guy, you know, it's run by a founder. Compared to Google, who the founders realized relatively early on, we better bring in a grown-up like Eric Schmidt to run this company because we don't necessarily know how. Well, Uber decided not to do that. But when they had all this swirl around them, they said, let's bring it. The board's going to bring in a law firm, right? Eric Holder, former attorney general, to look inside the company and see what they're seeing about some you know, possible bad culture and harassing behavior. Well, as soon as you have someone like Eric Holder, or in the president's case, Robert Mueller, rooting around your business for one thing, you've got no idea what he could find. And that is the pickle that the president could be in.
We're talking to Stephanie Ruhle, and I've got a few more minutes with her, or she'll never get back to New York and never be at her post tomorrow when we're supposed to be on television together. One of the reasons I made the transition, and I still love writing about sports. I still love sports and watching it with my kids, from writing a sports column to also writing a political column. There was a part of me, and we never know if we make any kind of difference, if we move the needle at all. But I felt like with you know, bringing young people into this world, I couldn't sit it out, and I wanted to say something. Is there a part of you that each morning when you get ready to do your show, and you're not proselytizing and you're not preachifying on your show, but there has to be a part of you that is happy that you're in a position where you might be able to make some kind of difference?
I'm happy. I'm very, very, listen, I love my job. I love being part of this. I'm super excited about it. I'm proud of it. I like bringing my kids to work to see it. But I'm also very, very scared. I'm scared about what a divisive time this is. I am scared about what a hateful time this is. You know, last summer, when the alt-right started getting sort of bigger and bigger, it was annoying me that we just call it the alt-right. It sounds like a radio station that plays Nirvana. But it was important to me that we articulated to the audience the kind of values or the kind of ideas that they support. You know, even if you say, oh, well, you know, InfoWars now has a temporary press pass at the White House. Well, I want to slow down and make sure people understand what an organization like InfoWars represents. You know, Jeremy Peters had a great piece in the New York Times this week where he sort of dissected conspiracy theories.
Yep.
He took one.
Yep.
And
yep.
Where they come from and then where they end up. Because I believe it was last week that the RNC, or maybe it was the Trump-Pence 2020, you know, campaign distribution that sends emails out. And in an email, it actually had an InfoWars piece. And when I saw it, I stopped the car and I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is an organization, a guy who believes 9/11, I mean, you're a New Yorker, Michael, that 9/11 was created by the government, that thought Sandy Hook, the massacre of kindergartners, was made up by these parents. Same thing for San Bernardino. We need to stop and slow the pace and say to people, I need you to understand what these organizations represent. They're not just news. And a lot of them, you know, something like InfoWars doesn't have a bad name, but the point that where it's scary, I remember last summer when I started to do that a little bit, I would read Breitbart headlines on my show just to put it into perspective. And whenever I would, the hate I would get on Twitter, or suddenly there'd be a blog post and it would say a few too many personal things about me, or where I'm from, or my husband's name. And I do think sometimes, Michael, it's a lot. It's a lot that we're taking on being in the heart of this. And I think that is scary. And we always have to check ourselves, because it's easy to say things and get over your skis, especially because this is such a heated time. And it's very, very important that we don't. And it's easier to do that. And it's an easier lesson to learn in business journalism. In business journalism, where I came from, you could move markets. You could affect jobs and companies if you get cute and you say things that you would at a cocktail party. You have to know what you're saying is rooted in fact. And given how emotionally charged politics is right now, we have to be so careful, because people are so angry and they only hear what they want to hear. But we have a chance, Michael. We have a chance. What if we can not be partisan? What if we can not be all the way to the right? I mean, I'm not a registered Democrat. What if we're not all the way to the right or all the way to the left? What if we're just trying to be good people who are trying to get through the day, kind of care about the planet, definitely care about our families, care about good capitalism, and want to respect one another? Is there a home for us? You could say Donald Trump might set good policies, and maybe he's a jerk sometimes. Why can't we be both of those things? And maybe being people in the media, we have a chance to do that. I don't know. I hope so.
I took we took our daughter to college orientation at the college that I had attended, Boston College, the other day. And we're walking across McElroy Commons. And I guess at Lehigh, what did you talk about? The hill?
The hill.
Okay. And I said to my wife, it's funny. It brought back a memory that the first political column I ever wrote for the school paper was about Kent State. So I come out of the 60s and into the 70s, and I saw what that was like. Stephanie, I honestly believe in the American life that I have led, this is the least civil time in this country since the Civil War. And you're right. Something's got to change. And if some good comes out of what happened in Alexandria, Virginia, on that ball field, then that tragedy will have actually helped us towards a greater good.
I'm going to flip it on the other side for a moment, though. I don't disagree with you about the state of the country, but this is the United States of America, where you can be an optimist, where every day we can wake up and maybe not do something great or grand, but we can do something good, and we can and will move the needle if we do more than complain, but we actually try to take some action. And that is one of the best parts about being American.
Oh, 100%. And when I say least civil, I don't mean the most dangerous. I said it's the least civil the way we talk to each other. No, it's when Trump got elected and there was all, we talked about this, and there was all this hand wringing. I said, wait a minute. In my lifetime, okay, in my lifetime, we shot President Kennedy, we shot Senator Kennedy, we shot Martin Luther King, we had Vietnam, we had a criminal enterprise being run out of the White House during the Nixon administration. God knows, with all due respect, God knows what kind of shape Ronald Reagan was in the second term of his presidency. Then came Bill Clinton and Lewinsky. And I kept telling people, we survived all that. We'll survive this too. But I want to get back to a question I asked. What can happen for Trump that stops all the negative momentum that he is experiencing over the last 3 or 4 months?
Policy. I mean, policy. At the end of the day, politicians will say to you, Republicans will say, Americans wanted us to repeal and replace. We said we're going to repeal and replace. We have to do that. And, you know, we have to build the wall. People don't care what the health care bill is called. They just want affordable health care. People don't care what you call the job program. They want to have a job. They want to make a living wage. They want to be able to go to work and not be on government assistance. The disparity between CEO pay and worker pay has never been greater. It doesn't matter if Donald Trump is a blowhard or if he has two scoops of ice cream and other people have one. At the end of the day, I don't think the American people know who Paul Ryan is or know who Jared Kushner is. They want to live good lives. And if the president can set policy or try to break the partisan divide and get people working together on infrastructure, on tax reform, then the American people are going to say, great, I just want a better life. Do I think the president can do that? Damn it, Michael, I don't know, but I sure as hell hope he could stop talking about all the nonsense he does and get to that agenda. And if he does, then I'm rooting for him.
You were great today. I know that I caught you on a very busy day. I hope I didn't make you miss your train and your shuttle. Stephanie, if I gave the impression that sometimes you used language that is inappropriate as we sit across from each other.
Then you're telling the truth.
Thanks, pal. I'll see you tomorrow on MSNBC.
I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much, Michael.
She's great. It's so much fun working with her. It's so much fun knowing her. This is the kind of conversation we have every week. This is why this podcast is growing in numbers from week to week. Please download it. Please subscribe to it. Go to the comment section. I'm sure, as I tell you every week, I haven't said anything to offend you, but there might be the outside chance that Ms. Rule did. I'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.